Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on The Conversation. It is Monday, May 18th. This morning, we consider what gets left behind. As military land leases across Hawaii are coming up for renewal, we survey the landscape of unexploded ordnance. And this week, we talk climate solutions. NPR is featuring local projects to find answers to climate problems. Today, we head to Maui, what a marshy wetland can teach us. A tongue-in-cheek workout video filmed on Hawaii Island is featured in a New York contemporary art exhibit. We talk to the Hawaii creatives behind the effort. And as we prepare to honor those who died in wartime, we learn about a new film to highlight the lasting impression that Hawaii soldiers have had on the world. 100 Seeds of Aloha. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Land power has been the focus of a recent multinational gathering of armies from across the globe. Star advertiser reporter Kevin Nodell has been reporting from the Land Pact Symposium in Waikiki that wound up last week as negotiations over state land leases are underway. One of the stories featured in the Sunday paper looks at unexplored ordnance left behind on training areas. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Catherine.
It's nice to have you in studio. You know, the headline of your story says deadly ground, and that's something that the military has had to deal with when it pulls back from its training and it leaves behind all that unexplored ordnance.
It's also something that the state and Department of Hawaiian Homelands and anybody else who takes on that land has to deal with.
Yeah, and it's not been an easy job. Talk about, you know, some of the issues that have come to light recently.
Some of these aren't exactly recent issues. They've been ongoing issues. Unexploded ordnance is a particular challenge in Hawaii for some pretty particular reasons that we have here locally. When you're looking for bombs that have been left behind, we have about a century or so of training at various training areas around the islands. So you have the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force having left a very wide variety of different sorts of munitions and bombs. And there are different challenges both with older ones that may have degraded and may not look like a bomb
yes.
anymore in the way that you might think, and newer weapons like cluster munitions that were used in Vietnam and through the 1970s that are not really used on the island anymore, but have been a real challenge when you're trying to clear areas. And the other challenge that we have here is just the terrain itself. On the mainland, desert training areas are pretty popular because, you know, they're wide open, they're sparse. You're not running into a lot of people, but also cleaning them up, you know, you can just kind of go through, you can look for any bombs that didn't explode. Here you have thick jungles, mm-hmm. we have slopes, and you know, it's difficult terrain that they like for training, but it becomes a challenge when you're trying to retrieve that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, just look at Ko'olawe, you know, right? How long that's taking to actually clear up the XO and to restore the land, you know? And they're talking about Makua as well, Makua Valley, right? As we talk about the land leases, you had a story on that recently, you know? So what if they give back some of that land and what about the cleanup?
It's going to be a long effort. One of the other challenges, Ko'olawe in particular, but an issue that they've found in Makua as well and on Big Island where they've been trying to build Hawaiian homestead lands on former military training areas is that the unique kind of blend of volcanic soil that we have here, you get a lot of iron and a lot of metals in the soil itself that you wouldn't get on a lot of mainland training areas. So when you're looking for metal explosives, you're getting a lot of false positives, and it really slows the process down a lot.
And then you were out at Schofield, and you did some reporting, you know, where they have things for the soldiers to look for, right? What you think is something, maybe something else.
For soldiers and also for civilian employees of the Department of Defense or anybody who may be going into areas where unexploded ordnance is more prevalent, but there's always at least a little bit of a possibility that you could run into it. One example that they showed was what I believe was a mortar round, but it looked more like tree bark just because of the rust and because of the way it had degraded over the years. So things don't always look exactly like what they are, but they can still be, even if they're degraded, they can be very dangerous.
Yes. And, you know, oftentimes this stuff gets uncovered decades after it's been sitting around, right? They're working on a construction project, like you said, the housing project there on the Big Island. But the hazards are there laying in wait. Yeah.
Even just the weather itself, the recent Kona lows uncovered a lot of unexploded ordnance as the soil was moved, turned into mud, and streams kind of washed over the mountains. Explosives went with them, and they've been recovering them around Makua and in other places as well.
Yeah, and then you were reporting from the LANPAC a conference in Waikiki, and I understand you've got a few more stories possibly in the works?
I do. There will be a few more coming out before I go on vacation this week.
Yeah, but it's interesting, you know, because of the two conflicts, you know, with Russia and Ukraine and the U.S. and Iran and what that means to our region here in the Pacific, as we hear of possibly some munitions being diverted. I think there were drones that were slated to come to this area and instead went to the other side of the globe. But yeah, just an interesting time that we live in.
Right. Yeah. And there was a lot of conversation at that conference about what they are seeing from those conflicts. And I don't know, this is my, I think, fifth LANPAC. So we kind of have the same conversations every year when we're there. But definitely one of the big things is drones were really at the center of the conversation. And particularly low-cost drones, low-cost munitions, because for a long time, the United States has really invested in these very high-tech, what they would call exquisite systems, very costly, very powerful, but also very hard to replace and very slow to build and to field and to get on the ground. And what we've been seeing both in Ukraine and in the Middle East more recently is the ability to quickly produce low-cost weapons, low-cost what we would call a delivery system, so drones that can carry explosives and mm-hmm. be a one-way drone.
Yes, the kamikaze drones
yes.
that we saw out in the field.
Because the United States has kind of invested in, over the years in making bigger and more
high-cost
high-cost drones. And because drones themselves were supposed to be expendable.
Right.
You would send them to do a job that a human wouldn't, but over time they also became expensive.
Right. Well, it's fascinating to see just the technology advance, the innovation in the tech field when it comes to munitions. But yeah, looking forward to your reports.
Thanks, Catherine.
We've been hearing from the Star Advertiser's Kevin Nodell. Look for his stories at staradvertiser.com.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ferraro Choi, interior architects for the new Hemic headquarters, committed to design that serves and celebrates the environment, culture, and community. FerraroChoi.com.
This week, we'll be focusing on local climate solutions. Today, we highlight a native ecosystem that scores high marks when it comes to climate resilience. Wetlands can store up to 5 times as much carbon as forests. They're rich in native biodiversity and can help protect coral reefs from runoff and absorb floodwater during storms. But they are vulnerable. Oahu has lost more than half of its wetlands over the last century. Scott Fisher has worked with the Hawaii Land Trust for more than 20 years, and it was around that time that the trust took over stewardship of the Wahee Refuge on Maui. Fisher spoke to HBR Savannah Harriman-Pote about bringing the native ecosystem back and preparing it for future impacts.
The nature of ecological restoration is to restore the structure, function, and composition of an ecosystem So, you know, we want to get the native plants in. We want to get the Lau Opala, the invasive species, out. But we also need to do predator control and, you know, ensuring the proper cycles of the carbon cycles and the nitrogen cycles are working to heal that ecosystem. The site at Waihe was a dairy between 1919 and 1970. And because of that, it had been dramatically transformed. And so what we need to do is get in there and start that healing process. The ultimate goal is to try and improve productivity, biodiversity, and then ecosystem resilience. And so we're focusing on how do we mitigate and prepare for the impacts of climate change. And so we do realize that with climate change, we'll get two things that really, really concern us most, and that is very intense pluvial events, rainfall events, like what we see or what we saw during the Kona Low. So we have these intense rainfall events that, because we have sand dunes surrounding the wetlands, will start migrating into the wetlands. So we have to prepare for that, make our ecosystem resilient, and also because we're on the coast, prepare for more intense storms and, of course, the continual threat, the ongoing threat from tsunamis. And so we have to make sure that this is at Waihe, that we have to prepare for both of those.
You've talked about Waihe, which the Land Trust took over ownership of more than two decades ago. That's a more than 200-acre parcel along the coast of Maui. And you've led a lot of the work there. Can you talk about, at that site, how these priorities of ecological restoration actually get achieved? How does that work actually get done?
Yeah, great question. At 277 acres, we need to kind of focus on what are the most significant, what are the most impactful areas to work. And so for the last almost 23 years, we've been working on wetlands restoration. And that really involves removing invasive species. So, for example, kiawe, which is Prosopis pallida, a non-native species, it is what's known as a phreatophyte. They come from a desert region of South America. And because it is a phreatophyte, it sucks up a lot of water. So just simply removing that invasive species, removing the kiawe that was both surrounding and in the wetlands, we've actually seen a dramatic change in the water level. But, you know, it's not enough. We need more water. And so one thing that we're doing in this wetland, so the wetlands are about 27 acres. About 6 acres of that 27 acres is a type of fish pond known as a loko iakalo. So this is built in the 16th century under the leadership of one of the Maui chiefs by the name of Pi'ilani. He oversaw the construction of a fish pond. And what we're doing is we're rebuilding that fish pond. And so this is under the leadership of my colleague Kia'i Collier and his group that he's formed called Kapoho Lima Ka'eo. And they have, you know, they're doing the Uha Humu Puhaku, the rock wall rebuilding. But we're also planning, since it's a freshwater fish pond, we are in the process of getting the permits for returning the water. So we are as close as possible restoring the water from the original source. It ultimately came from the Waihe'e stream, which is nearby, but we'll bring water back in and use that to restore the fish pond, and it will grow taro and we'll raise fish. It's a freshwater fish pond, so we can grow taro in there. And it's, you know, another means of actually helping to reduce the sediment that would otherwise go out into the ocean and during very, very heavy rainfall events would actually potentially cause damage to the reef. And so here it's actually settling out into our wetlands.
Mm. And in watching this ecosystem change for more than two decades, what's it like for you to see those changes and to recognize maybe small ways, maybe big ways that the health of the wetland at Waihe'e is improving?
I mean, I can look out now across Waihe'e and as well as our other sites, and we can see there are areas that are now dominated by native species. And that has not been the case for well over 100 years. We're seeing the return of endangered species, a target species. But just a general overall sense of health is what you feel now. You know, we have a ways to go. We're not there yet. We have probably generations of work to do. But just in the 20, a little over 20 years that we've been really actively working to heal the site, we've seen rebounds of everything from, you know, seeing more frequent visits by monk seals. We see birds that we know were reported in that area. I'm thinking in particular the northern pintail. The northern pintail was a common feature at the Waiheke wetlands that was recorded over 90 years ago, and we see them returning to Waiheke. So it's really exciting to see these things. But also a critical element is people visiting the site. They understand why this is so important. That's why education is such a critical element of what we do.
Healthy wetlands can be part of Hawaii's climate solution. They are natural carbon sinks, but they are also shoreline ecosystems that are vulnerable to climate change. In places like Waiheke, as well as Nu'u Refuge, also on Maui and under Hilt stewardship, I understand you're looking at past storms and tsunamis that have hit those areas to understand what events might occur in the future and how those areas might be vulnerable. Can you talk more about what's guiding your ecological restoration efforts in that regard?
We need some kind of guideline. The ecosystems that we work in have been dramatically modified, and we want to know what are the past disturbances. Ecological restoration really deals with the issue of disturbances, like, you know, when, as you pointed out, a tsunami or a storm changes those ecosystems. How are those changes manifest in the historical record? So we're doing a significant amount of paleoecological work. So that is doing both, for us, that's comes down to studying the pollen, the past pollen record. And so we can go back at Waiheke about 3,800 years to a time that's known as the end of the mid-Holocene high stand, when the ecosystem dramatically changed. And so we can get a profile of what plant species in particular were dominant, and then we can actually start working towards our ecological restoration work is working towards that. We also are doing a significant amount of what's known as archaeobotany. So we will dig test units in the wetlands, look at any plants that we find, and those plants, again, give us a guideline. We can date them, and we can actually identify them as a particular species. So at Nu'u in particular, some of the work we did there, we found 19 species that we had no idea were actually dominant there. Some of them we kind of could, you know, assume that they were probably dominant there, or that they were present at least. Others we had no idea. And so it came as a complete surprise, the species composition, that particular species was there. And so those two things are really feeding into our other studies. So I've just completed a recent study on the tsunami history, storm and tsunami history of both sites. And we found evidence of tsunamis that were largely unknown to science. A local tsunami that was described in a mo'olelo, a story from the Kahikinui Kaupo area on Maui, in the south coast of Maui. So we took that and began the kind of a study of that, and we actually found that it was actually a historical event, that mo'olelo was actually describing a historical event that occurred sometime around 1671, or perhaps a little bit more recently. And now we are actually trying to build what's known as a forested bioshield around our wetlands in order to protect it from tsunami inundation. And so we're using the native species that we found through the pollen record, through the archaeobotanical record, and then using them to actually restore the forest while also designing it specifically to attenuate sediment transportation into the wetlands. It's really part of our process of ensuring that we're as resilient as possible, which is critical to our efforts.
And all this week here at Hawaii Public Radio, we're talking about local climate solutions. And I'm curious, would you say in the work that you do in these refuges, is combating the impacts of climate change one of your primary goals? Or is that something that just starts to come naturally when you prioritize things like removing invasive species and protecting native species in these places?
Absolutely. I would say that climate resilience, just resilience in general, is integral to what we do. And that really, you know, we always knew that resilience was ecosystem resilience was a critical part of our ecological restoration work. But that was really brought home in March of 2011 during the Tohoku Oki Japan tsunami, that although it was we were spared from the majority of the destructive potential of a tsunami, but the wave that hit was 6 feet, a little over 2 meters, and it did some damage along the coast. But what we could do is we could compare areas directly that had we had undergone our ecological restoration work, and just down the coast where we had not been doing our work, and we could see that the native plants did a phenomenal job of ensuring the protection of that coastal ecosystem. So it both validated our ecological restoration work while simultaneously emphasizing the importance of resilience-focused ecological restoration work. That really kind of puts that as a centerpiece. So how to become more resilient. And so now we are working on creating bioshields both at Waihe'e and Nu'u. They both have their challenges, but that's really a critical function of what we're doing now.
That was the Hawaii Land Trust's Scott Fisher and HPR Savannah Harriman Poe talking about restoring Maui's wetlands. Look for links on our website to find out more.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Hawaii Department of Transportation, celebrating all graduates this season with wishes for futures that include choosing not to drink and drive.
The Trump administration is transforming the U.S. Forest Service.
The Forest Service has been looking at reorganization since 2007. There's been a lot of efforts to study this, a lot of efforts to consider reorganization, but we're actually doing it.
Critics say the Forest Service is being gutted, with research and regional offices closing, and fear that more public land will be opened up to private companies. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
A satirical workout video has been making waves across the Pacific. The Hawaii art piece is called 20 Minute Workout, and it's featured at the Whitney Biennale in New York. The exhibition is the longest-running survey of contemporary American art, and the video features a group of dancers in spandex workout gear stretching in front of the Captain Cook Monument at Kealakekua Bay while electronic music blares in the background. Sounds wacky, right? Well, an artist initiative called Kekahi Wahi is behind the video. Five members of the group dropped by our studios and spoke with HBR's Maddie Bender. You'll hear from Drew Broderick, Alex Singer, Maddie Bivin, Sean Connolly, and Sansia Nash. Broderick starts us off.
The project was an invitation for unrealized proposals that intervened into commemorative space on Hawaii Island. In particular, an obelisk that was erected in honor of a British Royal Navy officer, Captain James Cook. At the time, there was a lot of energy that was circulating around commemorative spaces and monuments across the continental United States. A lot of Confederate histories were being challenged, questioned, amended, removed, erased. And so the project was really a way to try to bring some of that energy to Hawaii and help artists here reimagine public space and what we were celebrating and what we weren't. And so it invited a number of artists to begin that process of doing research around the Captain Cook obelisk or Captain Cook monument at Kealakekua Bay. And from that project, a 20-minute workout work in progress emerged.
Yeah, I remember getting the call from Drew to participate in that project. And in the call, the project for the exercise video, I believe, was actually outlined as an example. So it's sort of this long dream of having an aerobics exercise video in front of the monument and then inviting other artists to iterate on that. And so my iteration for that project, I really didn't know what to do at first. And so I just thought to go down to the monument. I hadn't actually been there, despite growing up here, hadn't actually made it out to the monument in person. So I like made a pilgrimage there in a way, measured the monument, and then created a replica of the monument, which created a space for new opportunities. And so having a physical replica of the monument in my dwelling space ended up becoming a part of the project for myself, which I originally thought that I would maybe send the monument off to sea, like put it in a raft and float it off. But then I ended up getting a little bit more personal with it and started experimenting with self-portraits during the pandemic with the monument. And a story there unfolds.
You're being a little bit coy. This is public radio, but it's not a kid's show.
Sure.
Self-portraits. The video that's included in this overall 20-minute workout, this vignette, essentially, is of you positioning this shrunk-down monument. So it's like it's very phallic, and you're positioning it upright, and you're essentially stroking it. Why?
The obelisk is such a dominant form, and to suddenly be able to dominate it, I got just as having fun with it. And the great thing about working with friends on these kind of projects is there's an informality as compared to when you're working with maybe a formal institution. And I'd just be texting images to Drew or emailing the group or what it was with like half naked pictures of me with the obelisk in my bed, doing provocative things with the obelisk over the course of several weeks. And one of them, including an iPhone video of me having too much fun with obelisk in the mirror.
Hot.
Let's get back to the idea of the 20-minute exercise video in front of the monument. Drew, why?
We think of 20-minute workout, work in progress, the video as a resistance training video. It's parodic. It's satirical. It's joyous. At times a bit cringe. And I think there is something about working through history as a part of a group in public that lends itself well to the form of exercise. And I think the video in a lot of ways is trying to walk that kind of fine line between offering informed criticism of a past event and commenting on the absurdity of this present moment.
I think one concrete way that I was able to see in which you do that in the direction of it is there will be tourists in the background of some of your shots as Maddie is leading the group in this exercise routine. And you make it a point to film the tour boats and the snorkels. Talk a little bit about, you know, what that drawing that distinction and including that in like the visual part of this video meant.
Yeah, I think the experience of being down at Kealakekua Bay and also the experience of watching the film is kind of trying to have the viewer feel the simultaneity of sort of the layers of history that are felt and maybe also the contradictions that you might feel being in a place like Kealakekua that, you know, is like a wahipana. It's a sacred place that also has this really intense kind of over-tourism that is felt. And I think the way that we edit the film as well, kind of like interweaving historic paintings, bringing together sort of like local mashups, remixing music, that is all sort of like allowing the viewer to kind of like feel what it's like to be of Hawaii. The contradictions, the sort of like, yeah, the complicated histories that we are dealing with on an everyday level. I think that Maddie's character is, it almost feels like a Hawaiian Airlines commercial at times. You know, it's like, it's sharing this, like a, her rootedness to place, our rootedness to place, but at the same time having to the commercialization of a place as well, and it becoming sort of consumed this kind of sensuality or this kind of depiction of paradise being easily consumed. And for it to be in the context of the Whitney Biennial too, it challenges maybe the viewer to think beyond what they might project as Hawaii as a tourist destination.
Maddie, chime in here. I was struck by what Stancy was talking about, how you embody this character and choreographed this routine to be satirical, be part of this video. How did you go about choreographing it?
A couple things. So I, like many other people during COVID, started to do certain things online. And one of the things I started doing every day was like Pilates mat classes and like workout videos, resistance band stuff. So I think Drew and Sansi asked me to choreograph this video because they knew I was a dancer and performer, but it also worked really well because I was already making up workouts for myself at home, and I would even do them on the beach sometimes, like in my bathing suit, and like speak it out loud. So I was like, okay, perfect. Yeah, I can do this. But also one of our references was 20-minute workout from like the early 90s/80s era that our friend and collaborator Bradley Capello suggested and showed us as like inspiration that we could pull upon from to make this video. So I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's these women, you know, in like the jazzercise type high cut leotards, leg warmers, doing these videos where they're like pumping up and down, like upside down between their legs, and like doing like in ballet second position like squats, and just kind of like, it's a workout, but it's sexy and it's voyeuristic. The camera kind of like pans around them like 360, so you see them at different angles, like bending and contracting, and you know, their figures are very prominent, I guess, and it's fun. And so that was kind of like a visual that I was thinking about when I was choreographing for this. I guess I wasn't super thinking about how can I present this to be like exhibitionist, like to show. I just kind of wanted to have the workout be fun and a little bit dancey and like go with the music.
Mo'o reaches.
Yeah.
And as an element, it is like a real workout. Like I remember first watching it and like enjoying the process of like going through a 20-minute workout with the soundtrack and with those visuals. Yeah, definitely a testament to your range as like a choreographer and dancer, and also like the whole group. Like, yeah, everyone nailed it.
Yeah, it's definitely an actual workout. Like it was cut and spliced a bit in the video, but when we were practicing it and rehearsing it, we were doing it full on, like 4 or 5 minute sections basically with the bands. And I'm not gonna lie, like I grew a little booty, so the workout works. Testified.
I'll second that testimony because I swear I thought I wouldn't be able to do it because, you know, this like on and off sciatica. I sound so old when I say that, but it fixed it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, your workout fixed my sciatica.
Yay!
Alec, you and Sansia worked on the music aspect, the soundtrack, the songs. How did the two of you work together to make it cohesive?
Well, I'll say that Alec and I were like part of like a group of just like friends that like to DJ at house parties.
We've been making underground music for like a few years at this point. So
it's true.
Yeah, it's like not in the form of a mixtape, but I think in a different era, it would be on a mixtape that you could find and would be totally underground in that way.
And so, yeah, kind of just made those live, hanging out at house parties, mixing like Brother Casimero with like math or, you know.
Yeah, it's some like UK randoms stuff and different dance rhythms. Yeah. And like just being able to revisit these genres of music that come from Hawaii, and also being able to revisit that music in a variety of contexts is like, it's a lot of fun to enjoy that music, because like you have different reference points to those songs. And
it seems like for the two of you, that type of interpolation and mixing it comes from a place of love and admiration. And I almost think about that in contrast to filming the video in front of the monument, and your relationship to the monument is a lot more adversarial.
Maddie, just to comment on what you just said directly, mm-hmm. I think sometimes love looks like something else. And so the way we engaged with the monument for me, and everyone else can speak to this if you want, but that was an act of love through resistance. Mm-hmm. When we see what love through resistance looks like, we read it as something else. But at the foundation of this project, it really is about joy, about having fun with friends, with family, thinking about mentors in ways that really are about supporting relationships with one another and our relationship to place.
Relationship to place. Those were members of the Artist Initiative, Kekahi Wahi, Alex Singer, Maddie Bivin, Sean Conley, Drew Broderick, and Sansia Nash. The group's 20-minute workout video in front of the Captain Cook Monument at Kealakekua Bay is on view now through August 23rd at New York's Whitney Museum.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
I'm Marco Werman. The World's Newsroom brings you the big picture stories and some other stuff.
It may surprise you to learn, but in Italy, many, many mafiosi are religious.
You don't expect to find a swimming pool in the middle of the desert.
The rule number one when planning a golf course in China is to not call it a golf course.
Join us and hear the world.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters Kau Red Bourbon. Bourbon is a coffee variety known for its sweetness, full body, and fruit-forward flavor. Now available at BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com.
This morning, we spotlight a film that will debut a week from today, celebrating our rich history and the ties that bind us. The documentary is titled 100th, Seeds of Aloha, which pays homage to a proud history of Japanese Americans who fought in the war and who have left a lasting legacy. Director Steve Tsui popped by our studio Friday afternoon. You may know him as the Shaka Guy because of his film about the history of the little sign of Aloha. He starts with the decision to make this new film.
It was a process of about a year being convinced that I should do this film. I didn't want to do it because I was coming off the Shaka film. And I felt, as Mr. Aloha, it's kind of weird to do a military story. But it eventually ended up being something that really bit me. And so I did some research on it. And what I realized is that this unit is known as the Purple Heart Battalion. So they're 99% unit Americans of Japanese ancestry from Hawaii. And they use the Aloha spirit both in country during battle times and for 80 years following the war in times of rebuilding the world. So they did fantastic things for the world. And I thought that truly is an Aloha story I wanted to bring to light.
And you were able to travel to France for the 80th, the anniversary of the liberation of that town. I'm sure that must have been a heavy trip for you.
Oh, super heavy. So we did this enormous shot at Pearl Harbor, which, of course, you know, the Hangar 79 at Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum is literally ground zero for attack on Pearl Harbor. And besides the battleships obviously getting tanked, but that hangar still has strafing bullet holes in it. So it was really key place to do the opening shot for the film. So I go there and shoot that with 1,200 people coming to put medallions on a map, a 6,000 square foot map of Italy, France, and Germany. And the descendants of the soldiers came from all over the country and put medallions for where their loved ones had reached in the war. And we had these dotted lines on the floor of the 2,000-mile journey of the 100th, which eventually joins the 442, which is, everybody knows about the 442 here, right? The 442 is also about 58% from Hawaii. So they're also very imbued with the Aloha spirit. And what a great way to show how all these units combine. There's another unit, the 522, that's very much known, a field artillery battalion, that they come out of the 442 and head up to Germany, and they go all the way to Dachau, which is where the concentration camps are. So they free victims there, and they free victims from the death march, and very, very heavy stuff. And they all go to the end of the war. So they follow all the way from the beginning of what's called Operation Anvil in the southern part of Italy. They go through Italy, France, through Germany. So it's an amazing journey for AJAs in the war, a segregated unit that is really one of the most decorated in U.S. military history. So that's a big deal for us as a little state contributing in such a big way. And of course, it's one very small microcosm of the war. There's literally 60 million people that die in World War II. And I don't know how many millions of troops, but we're talking about 10,000 guys that put it on the line. This is despite being incarcerated, some of them. There's about 8% of the 442 that volunteered straight out of incarceration camps on the mainland. Just, it's an amazing story. It's very rich. It's very deep.
I remember being in Normandy, being on the shores there, and just the feeling of watching all the flags from all the nations fly. And it's just amazing the bonds that were formed because we had helped to fight right along with those soldiers.
Yeah, absolutely. And the whole Normandy thing is a completely different story of the war. It's a fantastic story. The time when Normandy was happening, actually the 442 wasn't in battle yet, but the 100th was, and they were just approaching Rome. And so they had liberated Anzio, which is on the beachhead outside of Rome, and they'd gotten all the way up to Lanuvio and Genzano. And there's a famous story about they're passed over for Howley soldiers that get to go into Rome on the march. And so that's one of the things in the film that to me is a very interesting thing, because there's obviously casts of racism in it. There's other views of why they might have been passed over. For example, they're known to be the best soldiers. And military historians will say that you want your best soldiers to go chase retreating troops. And we have evidence of that in this documentary of the leaders and the troops actually in interviews in the 80s. There's many ways to look at what happens in war. And for me as a documentarian, I just want to present all the different sides and let the viewers decide for themselves. To me, what's the most important thing is that these guys were truly among the best of people. I mean, they call them the greatest generation from that era. I know now why they are, having done this film. But I also know that among even the greatest generation, these particular units were of the highest valor, of the highest heroism. And that's the overriding story. When you add all of that together with the Aloha spirit, and they do all these wonderful things for people for 80 years, it's astounding what they achieved. Dan Inouye was one of them. My gosh, we named this movie Seeds of Aloha because they're literally planting seeds of aloha around the planet. And Dan Inouye was one of the biggest seed pods ever to have sprung from the state.
Was there anything surprising to you that came out of the filming as you went to these different places and talked to people?
Yeah, completely. The thing about going to Europe was we had shot the whole thing in the hangar, and then we knew the storyline that we wanted to cover. We had a very good historical backbone to work off of. So then when I planned this trip to Europe, and I had generals telling me, Steve, you need to get this done lickety-split, because this is the year America 250, this is the semi-quincentennial, the 250th anniversary of our independence. And they said, you need to finish this film this year. I'm like, I've only been at this for like 9 months. And we actually finished the film in less than a year, which is for a, you know, feature film with all custom music, with traveling to Europe for 3 weeks, doing really big shots, more than 1,000 people in a room. It's very aspirational, but I think you're going to pull this off. But to answer your question, in Europe, it really blew me away how much gratitude there is to this day. So you imagine that people that were victims, many of them were children at the time in World War II, today they're in their late 80s, early 90s, so they completely remember what happened. The soldiers were older than they were. Most of the soldiers are gone. There's only about maybe half a dozen 100th battalion soldiers remaining, and they're all over 100. So to go there and see how these people to this day teach their keiki, what it meant to be there and what all the allies did to set them free, and that they don't live under a Nazi flag today, they live and breathe it every day. They're very, very grateful for what the United States and Britain and Poland and it's just all these countries came and fought for their independence. It's very moving. And one of the things I did with this film is I really wanted to build it around the music because I didn't want to do another war documentary. That's just data. I wanted people to feel what it is to be in war and what it is to be saved and what it is to have aloha given to you, shared with you. And all the family connections that happen are just astounding. Like families travel back and forth from Europe to Hawaii. They really cherish this aloha spirit. They actually called the 100th 442 the Hawaiians. And that's how much aloha spirit was left in that country by our guys and has continued to be left by our travelers that go there and revisit the sites. So it's just astounding. Like I took my two music directors on this 3-week journey through Italy, France, and Germany. And the goal was to write all the music in country. And that's very aspirational because normally you don't bring music directors on a production shoot. But both of these guys are improv music artists, Harold Payne and Dave Kopatz, and they are complete top of the game. And have you seen David Ono's Defining Courage stage show?
Mm-hmm.
So Harold is the closing act in that show. He sings a song called Quiet Heroes.
Yes.
And the first time I heard that song, I was so galvanized. I was 2 measures into it. And I'm like, this is the guy. I gotta get this guy.
But that's so neat that you brought them there to have that sense of place and to inspire them to create music for this.
And boy, film. Did they. Yeah, so I would give them word clouds because I knew, you know, lyrically what I wanted because we're intercutting interview dialogue with the lyrics and we're playing the music beds through. We're not just playing the song straight up. There are some montages that you get the whole portions of verses and chorus line, but it's amazing to me how the integration of music really brings out the emotional elements. It allows you to connect so much better. And I think for Hawaii's people, very much so, right? Because we're a very musical state. So to bring this story to them in the format that completely touches hearts, it really couldn't be better. So I view this picture as a healing moment. You know, it's like we could talk about war all day, all night. That's boring to me. It's in the worst of times. Like you get a hurricane or a tsunami or a fire. You get insane rains this past winter and all the aloha spirit is out. So of course, in wartime, you're gonna have as much or more aloha spirit. For me, I think it's great if we can share aloha even in the quiet times. So the film to me is a way that now we're gonna be in quiet times. We're not in a disaster probably when this film gets released, hopefully not. There will always be another disaster. But in between disasters, if you can watch a film and still feel the aloha spirit and want to share it, there could be nothing better. So hence the reason to make a film.
We've been hearing from Steve Sue, the producer of a new film, The 100 Seeds of Aloha, honoring our veterans and the most decorated military war unit made up of Japanese American soldiers. We will have more after a short break. Let's get back to our conversation with Steve Sue, whose film 100 Seeds of Aloha will be screened on Memorial Day at the Moanalua Performing Arts Center. It is billed as a sponsor's cut before its official release. Sue picks up the conversation.
My music directors are all coming in and we're going to play some music, just a few songs. There's a full red carpet and all that because we're actually shooting a behind the scenes story of the making of the film and we needed a red carpet for this for the shot. So it's doubling as a set for a short. And I think it's a really fun short. One of the girls on our trip, she was a camera operator. She's camera B on our shot. Her name is Crystal K. Louise. And Crystal, she was on our Shaka film, and she's just a wonderful person. She's musically very talented. She wrote a song. So here's a person that's in their 20s that is so moved by the story of what the soldiers did and what happened in World War II. And she just went as a camera operator. She was like zero interest in this story. But she gets moved by it. She writes a song. And we're like, this is a really great song. Let's do a behind the scenes on this because she's in the tour bus with a guitar. And we're traveling far, so there's plenty of time to write a song. She writes a song, blows me away. And so I said, why don't we do a behind the scenes piece on you? And we're going to see if she'll maybe sing her song the night of the premiere. And if she does, then we have a little really nice BTS shot. Because in a way, this is our version, our Hawaii version of A Star is Born. Because she's not a professional singer, but she's got the gumption to try to get up on stage. And my music directors will back her up, I know. So it'll show Ohana any way we cut it. If she ends up being perfect, great. If she's not perfect, then we'll support her. So the night of the 25th of May, which is Memorial Day, and incidentally, I was going to do the sponsor's rough cut screening on 4th of July, because that's what the America 250 committee wanted to do. And I was down with that. And then Manager Blangiardi says, no, it has to happen on Memorial Day because that's the veteran holiday. So we moved it up a month, which, of course, remember I mentioned this is less than a year in production. Right. So a month is a lot of time for us right now. But we said, yeah, we'll rise to that. The city's helping us out. They're sponsoring the screening. So that's really nice. It's at Moana Lua's new performing arts venue. It's gorgeous theater. We've shown Shaka there several times, and it's a great place to screen a film. And so, yeah, so we're doing that on Memorial Day. And then 2 days before that, because all my music guys are in town, we're doing a live concert of all the music. So we had written 9 original songs and 8 musical. In fact, you want to hear some of it?
Sure.
Let me play you something really fast. So here's a song. Do you know they're called the One Puka Puka?
Yes.
Okay. Do you know why they're called the One Puka Puka?
No, I do not.
Well, because 100. A puka is like a zero, right?
Gotcha.
So this song is called One Puka Puka.
Hey, Mr. Hitler, what you gonna do? Here comes the One Puka Puka and the 442. Herr Mussolini gonna get you too. The Potomacs and the Buddha heads are coming after you.
Love it, love it.
You like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've got, it's not the obvious music you get in a military piece, right? Because I want to keep it interesting and light and fun. And that's all history. That's, this particular song plays in this era when the 100th goes to training camp. And they're well known for playing baseball with all the surrounding communities and just really being goodwill ambassadors. So it turns out that some of them even went back to Wisconsin area where they were training and married people from there and settled there. To this day, there's complete ties. Yeah, in fact, there's a teacher there, Mickey Maddox, who's putting together a tour for us for the film. And we're going to visit all the towns in the area of Sparta and La Crosse, Wisconsin, where they played baseball. And we're just going to connect with people there and show the film. And we're going to do a history harvest, which is people that have memorabilia from the 100th being there can come and show it, very much like Antiques Roadshow. So we're having a lot of fun with it. And it's just amazing the stories that come out. You know, we could only put so many stories in the film, but it's just super fun to watch everybody. Yeah. Oh, I have a story about somebody's uncle or this or that. Or I have this baseball.
And you've got the threads that just go out in the... across the globe, right?
Literally across. Yeah. These guys were like everywhere at once. They helped Japan get back into the Olympics in 52. They organized pigs from the sea to to Okinawa. There's just countless things that they've done. Helped Hawaii get stated. All
the
Dan
greatest generation, right? That's why they call them that.
Yeah, it's incredible what they did.
I can't wait to see it. The 100th Seeds of Aloha on Memorial Day.
Yeah. Thanks for having us, Catherine.
Thank you so much for being here.
Mahalo.
That was Steve Sue, who produced the Shaka film and whose latest creative effort is titled The 100 Seeds of Aloha. It premieres in a VIP screening on Memorial Day at the Moanalua Performing Arts Center. And that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to get an update on the super typhoon response from the Army Corps of Engineers. Have a story idea to share with us? Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation as a podcast. Head to our website or search for it on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.